Friday, April 17th. This morning I spent with Mrs. J. Lee Johnson, Ruth Carter Johnson, daughter of Eamon Carter, a can-do woman, very much her father's child, pretty, young, and blonde, but terrifically in earnest about being a regent on the board of the University of Texas, and about turning her father's Eamon Carter Museum of Western Art into an expanding, vital museum. We talked about the possibility of her lending to the White House for Lyndon's offices at the Fish Room, a Remington or a Russell, and then we went down and looked at the wonderful bronze coming through the rye by Remington, which their museum had presented to the White House 2 years ago. It's on the ground floor, lit up, thank heavens, by a good spotlight. And one of the best contributions from my part of the United States to this house. We went gingerly through the Fish Room and the lobby, which I consider dull, musty, and devoid of personality, and talked about how to bring some color and vividness and comfort into them. But except for pictures, that will have to come later if I have anything to do with it. And then I got a message from Bess that we could go to the Corcoran Art Gallery and see the John Singer Sargent exhibit, The Private World of John Singer Sargent, which opens to the public tomorrow. And since she had already talked about how much she would adore getting to see it and would not be here tomorrow, we just simply jumped in the car and went off on an adventure. We were met at the door of the Corcoran by the curator and then went on a quick tour of the exhibit. Sargent had always been to me a beautiful woman in a white satin gown, a sort of American counterpart of the Gainsborough, Romney, Reynolds, Rayburn School, the painter of the sleek and well-to-do. But he was a man of many moods and many arts, and I found that I liked best of all the watercolors. After about a pleasant 2 hours in all, we said goodbye, and I hope that I had made a friend for art for the White House down the road somewhere. The rest of the afternoon went into office work and to planning for the reception for the American Society of Newspaper Editors, 1,200 all told, who were converging on us at 5:30 in the Rose Garden. In my white suit, I joined Lyndon at his office with Linda Bird in tow and an SOS for Lucy to come as quickly as possible. It was a beautiful day, thank heavens. The editors filed into the Rose Garden and spread out onto the South Lawn. There was a podium. I said a word of welcome, and Linda Bird did rather well in her few little words. And then Lyndon made a speech which got off on a light note with a few jokes, and then plunged into the story of what faces him, a president's duties, the civil rights issue, his war on poverty, amplified by many good statistics, and a line I like very much about turning tax eaters into taxpayers, and that dreadful figure about 49% of the young men who are called up by the draft being found physically or mentally unable to be taken by the Army. Then he went into Medicare and the pay bill, and then the railroad talks. There hasn't been a night that we've come in the last few nights and my eyes haven't turned to room 208 in the EOB, wondering, praying, hoping for what they were doing. And then he ended with what I thought a lot of them listening probably regarded it as an evangelical appeal for unity, for compassion. There was a line, and from our science and our technology, from our compassion, from our tolerance, from our unity and from our heritage, we stand uniquely on the threshold of a high adventure of leadership by example and by precept. If there is judgment in history, it rests on us according to our generosity or our disdain. These are the stakes to make a world in which all of God's children can live or to go into the dark. For today, under the shadows of atomic power, it is not rhetoric, but it is truth to say that we must either love each other or we must die. I expect the cynics were giggling good, but we may well look back on this decade as a time at which the United States could rise to that kind of leadership, or in failing, fail all. At the last moment, Lucy came in and got to say her small word, and then we filed into the White House for food and drink in the state dining room and dancing in the East Room. Mr. Miles Wolf, the incoming president of ASNE, was going to take me around and introduce me to just as many people as we could meet, since it's pretty nearly impossible to stand in line and meet 1,100 or 1,200. And Mr. Herbert Brucker, the present president of ASNE, was going to accompany Lyndon around. Besides all the Texans we had seen yesterday, there were the Barry Binghams of Kentucky, the young Harry Byrd Juniors of Winchester, Virginia, the Harding Carters Jr., who were taking his father's place, his father's ill. She's Marcia McGee, George McGee's daughter, and so attractive. The Otis Chandlers from California, the Turner Catledges of New York, Willie Snow and Mark Etheridge, and how delightful to run into David Hall, whom I introduced around as my first editor. He was editor of the Daily Texan when I got a Bachelor of Journalism degree in 1934, and he's improved with the years. Very attractive. George Healy, with whom I had a good talk about the GPA Healy's in the White House, and told him I thought there were 6, and he told me, no, 15. 92-year-old Mr. Heiskell of Arkansas, the oldest of all the lot. The Epp Hoyts, whom we've known for more than 25 years, he used to be with the Portland Oregonian and is now from, I believe it's Denver. And I had asked Gary and Jack Hopkins to come. I thought two kinfolks could very well be lost in a crowd of 1,200 editors. It was also fun to see DeWitt Reddick, head of the Journalism Department of the University of Texas, and impressive to meet Mr. and Mrs. Joseph Pulitzer, Jr., and two families of Scripps from the Scripps Howard chain. Mr. Wolf, bless him, took me through all the rooms, and we shook hands here and there with as many as we could find, and then for a moment strolled out on the balcony with Dave Hall to take in the serenity of the Washington Monument and to try to capture a personal moment. And then we danced. I was broken in on about every third step. And I hear that later, one time Lyndon said, between clenched teeth, to Bess over his shoulder, get those aides to dancing. I doubt if the editors and their wives ever saw so much or did so much in the White House within 2 hours' time. Actually, I can only hope they liked this party as well as the women liked the one at the Elms this same month last year, because at least 40 women came up to me and said, we still remember that wonderful time out on your terrace last April. The wisteria, the South American music, and such a nice family atmosphere. Finally, about 8, they began to melt away. We took the Turner Catledges upstairs for a final bit of conversation and drink, and then an early but weary dinner, the large envelope of bedtime reading, and eventually good night to the world.